Welcome to episode 51 of Meenal's World. Thank you for joining me again this week, and thank you for all your lovely messages after my, I guess you can call it a comeback last week. It's a Thursday night, and as usual, I've done this all last minute because somehow I think Radhika's going to behave really well, and then she doesn't, and then it's Thursday night, and I'm just like, oh god, it's Friday tomorrow.
Daddy.
Radhika, do you have anything to say? Okay, I guess not. She's currently sat on my lap, but it's 9:20, it's way past her bedtime, but I had to get it done somehow, in some form. This week I spoke to Catherine Mayer, and I've listened back to this episode several times because I couldn't figure out what soundbite to use. I couldn't figure out what soundbite to use, I couldn't figure out what quotes to use because her story is incredible, her ideas are thought-provoking, and she really is just an inspiring woman. And I mean, you can keep going back to this episode and you'll find more and more gems each time, but I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I did recording it. And remember, if you are joining me for the first time, please do subscribe to the podcast. It does help. And you can always find more information, more episodes on my website, which is www.meenalviz.com. So before Radhika breaks the microphone, I'll let you carry on. This is Catherine Mayer. Welcome to the show, Catherine. It's so nice to finally just sit down and have a chat with you. I know we've been meaning to catch up for a long time. We've been in touch over Twitter, but it's really nice to just sit down and have a chat.
I agree. But funnily enough, this has been a period of time where sitting down and actually having a proper uninterrupted chat has been strangely difficult. You know, we went from that period of lockdown where all we did was stare down the barrel of a Zoom just to a kind of, I don't know, I mean, for you, I guess it's always been manic, but for me now also manic. So I'm really pleased that we can do this, though I'd even better if it was in real life, but there you go.
Can't, it's all right, Catherine. We're getting close to that. I've met Lisa, I've met your sister, so hopefully the next person member of the family will be you. I tell my husband all the time that when we met Lisa and we had Radhika with us, I think she was probably about 3 months, Lisa was the only person who could bottle feed her. She wouldn't take the bottle from anybody else, so now we're kind of tempted just to take her back just so that she can convert again and go back to the bottle. But I really hope we can meet up soon, Catherine. I know that we've been meaning to catch up for a while, but I've been thinking about, you know, for a long time, how to get you on the podcast and what we can talk about. And I know you've done so much over the last 20, 30 years. And I want to know more about you as a person, Catherine. And I think that we see stories of people online, but we tend to forget that these are real humans who've had a history that maybe the media doesn't cover. So let's go right to the beginning, Catherine. You were born in the States, in the USA. What was it like over there? And how old were you when you moved to the UK?
There's a complicated answer to that, only because my family moved around a lot. So and it's really a funny thing, because of course I've recently written a memoir with my mother, and we find that we don't all agree on the dates of what happened when. But effectively, I only lived in the States as a pretty small child, sort of up to the age of 10, but not solidly up to the age of 10, because we went back and forth. And we mostly were coming to this country, to the UK, but we also, for example, had a really brief stint in Greece. But I do have very vivid memories of, I was born in Wisconsin in a place called Appleton. And funnily enough, one of my, or quite a few of my early memories relate to politics. My parents were politically active to the extent that I understood when there were presidential elections going on, I understood which posters were of the right person, which posters were of the wrong person. But also the Vietnam War was going on. So there was a lot of activism. My father was teaching at the university there, and there was a lot of anti-war activism. And I found at some point some early diaries I'd kept. And even as a really small child, I was writing about the Vietnam War. I mean, obviously not with any insight, but it was something that was part of my consciousness. So there we were in the Midwest of America, in a place that is quite, you know, small, a pretty small place with a lot of kind of farming communities around it. And yet somehow this really strong sense of the outside world.
How important was this to shape your future? Because obviously you went on to found the Women's Equality Party, and we'll go into that a bit later. But what were your like dinner table conversations like with your parents? I mean, you said that you were there till about the age of 10, so you were very, very young. How conscious were you about what was going on around you?
Well, it's funny. I mean, I say I've got vivid memories. A lot of the memories are of things like the sort of typical childhood memories, like foods that I really liked or really didn't like, or the extreme weather, very extreme climate there. So incredibly cold winters where our car would disappear under the snow and you had to extend the aerial and put a flag on the end of the aerial so that the snow plow didn't roll over your car. But that political hinterland, that was really present. That's what I mean. I mean, you know, it's sort of, it's some of it was, we literally had, at one point we were looking after an iguana that somebody who had dodged the Vietnam draft had left this iguana with my parents. So we had to kind of feed grapes to this iguana to keep it alive. But I also remember things like, I'm not old enough to remember the shooting of President Kennedy, but I absolutely remember the shooting of Robert Kennedy. And I remember also being confused about it, though, because I thought that I mistook the name of his assassin for saran wrap, which is the American phrase for cling film. It was actually saran saran. There were all sorts of other things that I picked up on, but without fully understanding, you know, a lot about, you know, this was the 1960s. So I picked up a lot about kind of 60s counterculture, but it was more a texture to life rather than having a proper understanding of any of it. But I'm sure it must have been influential.
Do you think that played a part in your desire to become a writer?
Oh, the writing thing is easier to trace. I mean, it's one of those funny things where, first of all, it's something that pretty much everyone in my family does. And not everybody does it formally, but even the people who aren't published writers are people who express themselves through writing. And so, you know, the way that works with families, it's the sort of thing that very often gets mistaken for being a particular talent, or even, you know, the nonsensical idea of these things being somehow genetically gifted. Whereas in fact, what of course it really is it's the culture you grow up in and the thing that's normalized for you. And so I come from a family where pretty much everybody is in some form of entertainment or writing or expressive kinds of careers. I mean, I have one of my first cousins who I love very much is a baker, but that's also, she's a baker and chef, and that's also sort of a creative profession. So it's just what people here do. People in my family. I was getting distracted. The listeners won't be able to see this, but I just got attacked by a fly, which at this time of year, I have no idea where that came from.
We can investigate that later, Catherine. Catherine, you know, you talk about writing and how it sort of, I guess, runs in your family. And I think that writing in my family, for example, was never spoken about. It was never really a thing. And I think a part of that was because when I was raised in Gibraltar, we were just outside playing all the time. And that was sort of my form of therapy. And we never had to turn to anything else. Whereas a lot of my friends I speak to who are writers and poets, they said that was their form of therapy. So apart from writing being your profession, how important has it been not just obviously now with the pandemic and everything that you've been through, but just generally in your life, how important has that been to face difficult situations, whether it's family or work life?
It's not even just difficult situations. It's literally what I do. I do it every day. I think this is the thing. I know lots of writers who don't even particularly like writing and who struggle with deadlines. Everybody struggles with deadlines a bit, but who get really tormented by writing and don't understand the way I am about it. And I get up in the morning with the spring in my step on the days where I don't have to do something else in the morning and where I can go and write for myself. So even when I was a staff journalist and I had pieces to write and deadlines and all that sort of work-related writing, I would anyway carve out time to write other stuff that was just for myself. And as I say, it's not just a therapeutic thing. It's something I'm compelled to do. So I have never published fiction, for example, but I write fiction all the time. I write poetry all the time. But I just do that for myself. And the outward facing stuff, nonfiction and journalism, is the thing that I've done professionally. It might not always stay the same. I may eventually publish some fiction or poetry, but as I say, it's, I don't know about the therapeutic aspects of it. I mean, maybe it's a form of therapy, but writing is a sensation that I love. And it's really hard to explain that. But I think maybe people who like to sing or like to do sport or something would understand it, because it's also a muscle memory. You know, it's something that you just go and do, and you know when it's going well, but you also know when it isn't.
do you feel different on the days you don't write? Because it seems like it's just such an important part of your day, just like breathing. I mean, when you don't write, do you feel different within yourself?
Yes, I get very frustrated, and I feel like a sort of build-up of something. So that's quite depressing. I mean, today, actually, I thought that I was going to be able to do some writing for myself, but I've got so much going on at the moment that I couldn't. So even though I've had a perfectly decent day, there's part of my mind that feels that this is a lost day because I didn't get to write. Even just
I hope it isn't, Catherine. I hope it's not a lost day, because we're having a nice conversation. So hopefully... But Catherine, I was reading somewhere, I don't know if it was an article or tweet that you put out, but you mentioned that you wake up quite early in the morning to write, and you're most productive, you said, between like 4 a.m. and midday. So even like on the winter dark days, you still manage to get up that early?
Well, at the moment, that's one of the reasons I'm being a little less productive, is that my sleep patterns are out of whack at the moment. So I only got up at 6 today rather than 4.
That's not acceptable, Catherine.
4 is actually my favorite time, is funnily enough, is between there. I like to get up at 5 and just come straight to my computer and start writing at 5 without doing, the only thing that I stop to do is collect a giant mug of tea, and then that's it.
Wow. Is it, Catherine, when you were working as a staff journalist at that time, what was it like you mentioned that writing is just part of what you do, but when there are big news stories out there, it's really difficult to sort of keep up, and it can get quite stressful as well. I mean, we look at the pandemic, I've seen lots of journalists, and they've just had the foot on the pedal for the last 18, 20 months, and they haven't stopped. Did you ever feel that you were burning out at any point, or was it just something that you just love so much that you never felt it?
Oh no, you feel it, and I mean, that's funny coming from you, the idea of working hard and burnout, because I mean, my god, that must be something familiar to you. The thing about doing writing for a living is it's not self-indulgent in the same way. So part of being a good journalist It's a bit like being a good cook. You know, it's all very well being somebody who can produce a fantastic meal, but unless you produce it at a time that it's actually due on the table, it's not really that much of an achievement. So you have to be able to write often to a kind of predefined space, and within whatever the constraints are of the working conditions, you know. So I've reported from not just from the comfort of my own office or desk, but from on the road and often in quite challenging circumstances. And then the thing is to bring it all together, and to bring it all together in a way that actually does the job you want it to do. So I mean, again, with journalism, there's I think a lot of misunderstanding about the extent to which there is ever such a thing as neutral reporting. You know, every form of journalism embodies something of who you are and who and the whatever the news organization you're writing for will have its mark. But within that, if once you acknowledge that, there are still all sorts of ways in which you can ensure that it is the most accurate, the most trustworthy, all the things that matter, and matter even more these days. So again, I think you think about the writing, but you also think about, you have to think about the content, you have to think about the fact checking, you have to think about the, you know, double and triple sourcing, you have to think also about the impact of what you're writing and why you're writing it. So there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, I was an editor as well as a writer, so you know, it's sort of second nature to me to think also in terms of where it will sit within a publication and you know, where it is within the arc of a story.
How do you think journalism has changed over the last 20 odd years, Catherine? Because obviously when you started off, it must have been quite different, because now everything's online, everything's on the internet, and we've got lots of online outlets which become more popular than the traditional newspapers. And it's always like a double-edged sword kind of thing. Well, we have so much information, but at the same time, I don't really know if that's good or if that's bad, because we're saturated at such a point with all this overload. I don't know if it's actually benefiting us anymore.
There are lots of answers to that. It's a huge question, but I think overall, there's lots of very worrying things happening. You're very kind to say 20 years. My first job in journalism was at The Economist, and I started that job in 1983. So I was...
We'll say 20 years, Catherine. We'll keep it at 20 years.
Well, no, but it's actually... That timing's important, because I actually was there for the last days of a hot metal press when you had to... When I was there, when I first was in journalism, we used typewriters, and if you edited something, you actually literally physically cut it up. And, you know, people talk about cut and paste, but they don't realize that cut and paste was a real thing. You literally cut and pasted it in a different order.
I didn't know that, Catherine. That's interesting.
See, that there are advantages to being ancient. You know, I carry this level of Pleistocene era history with me that you know, might be interesting to people. But I was there when the first sort of computers, which were of course very clunky, but when computers were introduced, and I remember also how easy and how I was a very early adopter, and I would see my older colleagues struggling with this. And I was going to say my older male colleagues, but the point about that was that when I was working at The Economist in the early 80s, there were hardly any women on staff. And I mean, it was nearly all posh white men. And you can, I guess one of the questions one would ask about that is about how little that aspect of things has changed. So, and I don't just mean at The Economist, I mean, you know, across the board, at the BBC, whatever, wherever, wherever you look at the staff who are producing the news, it's still overwhelmingly white men from privileged backgrounds in this country. What is a serious story? You know, there's always a very male view about what a serious story is as well. So some of that stuff hasn't changed nearly as much as one would like it to have done. But what has changed, and with pretty disastrous effects, is that journalism failed to understand what the digital revolution actually meant, and that the digital revolution would destroy the economic models that sustained serious long-form journalism. So things like, you know, newspapers and magazines, news magazines, would sell display advertising, and that was a huge part of their income, as well as also charging readers per copy. And of course, the thing about the digital world is not only did everybody very quickly come to expect the content for free, but the advertising revenue was never going to replace the revenue lost from this print display advertising. And so the whole economic model broke, and everybody has been thrashing around ever since to try and find ways to replace that model. But where the cuts have come have been to numbers of editorial staff. So just for example, when I started at Time magazine in 2004, there were bureau chiefs in most of the kind of key countries in Europe, in the Middle East, quite a lot across Africa. By the time I left, there were hardly any. I was the last bureau chief in Europe for quite a long time. And then when I was Europe editor, I had hardly any bureau chiefs. And what that inevitably means, a diminution of quality, because if you don't have people on the ground to do the reporting, you're either going to use freelance work, which may be of very high quality, but it's of less certain quality. And the people doing the reporting are also very often not, for example, paid enough or insured by the organization. So if they're in war zones, they're in danger. And you also just sort of tend to do more what's known as churnalism, as in you recycle reporting that other organizations have done. And of course, these days, you see so much journalism based on what somebody tweeted. You know, it's one of the things, you know, you and I are both kind of enthusiastic tweeters, but one of the things that does worry about that is that I've just dashed off on Twitter, even just a single tweet or a thread will reappear as an article somewhere about 10 minutes later. You know, and that's not journalism, that's churnalism. It's journalism if you take somebody else's reporting and you don't really properly fact check it or anything, you just repeat it, and then it becomes like one of those party games where you whisper to your neighbor, and with each successive whisper, whatever the phrase is gets more and more distorted. I have a feeling I'm ranting now, aren't I?
No, not at all, Catherine. Yeah, everything that you're saying is very interesting, and I agree with everything that you say, because the next thing I wanted to talk about actually was your lawsuit with Time magazine, because you're talking about journalism and how news is spread out so quickly. And you have mentioned previously that during that time, the whole thing had a big impact on your mental health, and that actually manifested into some physical symptoms as well, because it was a very stressful period. Now, I remember when we started our legal challenge, I say we because it was my husband and I, early last year in 2020, all we did, Catherine, was write a letter to Matt Hancock and his team. That's all we did. And the next thing you see is we're on Good Morning Britain with like massive titles saying doctors sue government. And I'm like, we haven't sued anybody. There's no money involved. We've just written a letter to the government. And, you know, I we're very lucky because in some sense, our story gained a lot of traction thanks to the internet. It's one of those things where our crowdfunder got a lot of traction, and we gained a lot of attention within a very short period of time, which we probably wouldn't have if the internet wasn't around. So that was the positive side. But obviously the negative side was that you're getting phone calls all the time. Everybody knows who you are within the space of, like, you know, a few hours. And people are just making up their own headlines without fact checking with the actual person. So that was downside of it as well. When you were going through this lawsuit with Time Magazine, I understand that you wanted to keep it private at the beginning. But then because the case was of public interest, then you decided to speak up about it. So what was that time like for you? I mean, how did you feel? Because it's a very big step to take.
Yeah. Well, and by the way, I think your point about what happened to you is 100% right. You know, the Women's Equality Party wouldn't exist if it weren't for the possibility of sharing things on social media. You know, social media is not an unalloyed bad thing at all. The internet is by no means a bad thing, but it's the interaction between the media, new media and old media, and between analog laws and our failure to even understand what this stuff is doing to us as a society and culture and everything else that is problematic. And you experienced one of the rough ends of it. So, and you also experienced the ways in which journalism has become very much depleted in quality, because nobody should be saying you were suing the government when you weren't. Nobody in a you know, a well-funded public broadcaster should be saying that either. You know, I mean, it's, as you saw, it's not just the small outlets that do that. So it's very interesting, because quality's gone down everywhere. But, you know, in answer to your question, I mean, the time thing, what happened there was, I wasn't originally intending to sue at all. I was not, there was a point where they did some things. I'd had a wonderful kind of 8 years there, and then it started to go wrong for all sorts of reasons. And those reasons, I was convinced, were down to sex and age discrimination, and to a colleague who was working to sort of get me out at all costs. And I was originally, there was a point where they did something so stupid that I could have just had an open and shut case and sued and won in a second. But I didn't immediately pursue that, because I was involved in a project that I wanted to see through to the end. And then at the end of that, they kind of confected a redundancy for me, which was obviously confected, and where obviously they were supposedly eliminating my job, but they were just about to then give that same job to somebody else, which of course is not permitted under employment law. And I happened to talk to a former colleague who really, you sometimes need somebody's outside eye to look at it. And they kind of said, you really should do something about this. And I thought about it, and I thought, actually, you know, probably I really should do something about this. Because I've always been really glad that I did that. But at first, of course, the reason you don't is because it's frightening. That's what you'll have found. It's frightening, the idea of being in the public eye. One of the things about being a journalist is you have the tables turned the other way most of the time. You know, since 2015, I've had to start giving interviews like this one, though this one's nice, but I've had to give hostile interviews as well about myself or what I believe or whatever. And that's being on the receiving end of something that I guess journalists in some ways dole out all the time. And I never wanted to be in the public eye. But I particularly, with the Time lawsuit, when I first started pursuing it, I guess I wanted justice, but what I wanted almost more than that was to set a kind of precedent so that they wouldn't do it to other people. And but I decided to sue them in the States, and that's what changed the game so substantially, because in America, your complaint, as it's called, the basis of your lawsuit, is published as soon as you... Oh, I'm sorry. Funnily enough, that's the sister we were talking about. I thought I'd turned WhatsApp off. I beg your pardon.
That's okay.
I first went to something called the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission in the States, and they said that Time Magazine had a case to answer. And so then it went to the courts, and at the point where it went to the courts, my account of all the things that went wrong and Time's response to that became public. And as soon as they became public, legal journalists who trawl these sorts of things for information immediately saw the story and immediately ran a story in the US with the headline, top journalists sues Time for sex and age discrimination. And at that point, I was terrified, because I just thought that I would become the focus of every attempt to discredit me possible. But instead, what happened, and although this wasn't ever a case about sexual harassment, it bears all sorts of similarities and resonances, because what happened is, when my story became public, all sorts of other witnesses came forward and testified to similar things having happened to them. So it turned out, instead of being scary and awful, it turned out to be a sort of validation and something that brought enormous more support to my case. Really, literally, I spoke to the Observer newspaper here, and within a day or so of that Observer piece being published, I just started getting all these offers of support and people giving me their testimony of their own stories. And after we finish talking this evening, I'm actually meeting with somebody who is themselves going through a similar situation. And what's happened ever since the Time lawsuit is that, because it was public, people who are considering pursuing this sort of legal action often come to me to talk about what it's like. And I feel that that's something I can kind of give back, is I never urge people to do it, because in the end, there are many risks, and the risks are not all financial. They're like, do you want to be employed again? You know, there's all that sort of stuff. But I think it's very helpful for people to talk through what it's like.
Do you think that you could have sorted this out, this issue out, the specific issue of yours, without going to court? Is this something that you try to do as well?
Mm.
And I only ask this because a few days ago, I was reading about a lady. Name was Tilwinder Kaur. She was a nurse in the 80s, a Punjabi lady. And she was studying to be a nurse in the UK. And she said that she didn't want to wear a skirt as a nurse. She felt uncomfortable wearing a skirt, and all she wanted to do was wear trousers. So she tried to change that rule that only skirts were allowed. She tried to escalate, and it didn't work. And then she ended up taking it to court, and they settled the matter. And then women were then allowed to wear trousers if they were nurses in the hospital. But then in an interview, she said, I just wasted a year of my life because I got what I wanted anyway. But it's a shame that we had to go through that effort and that manpower to go through the court to get what I wanted. So do you think that you could have solved your specific issue outside?
No, I couldn't. I mean, when it started, and interestingly, the person who I'm seeing later, I think, has got a very similar situation. Organizations are remarkably stupid. And the handling of my case was remarkably stupid, because I had a very strong case. And if they had what they think they can do is they think they can bully individuals, they can scare you into not pursuing your case. And they should have understood that that was not going to happen with me. It's not going to happen, I think, with the person I'm talking to later. And therefore, they're not just wasting, they are wasting a year of your life or 2 years of your life, but they're wasting their own time and money. And in the end, they'll do damage to their reputation because it will break out into the open and they're the losers. So it's a difficult one. I mean, I think in my case, it would probably literally never have been settled because it would have required them to, it would have required them to accept, instead of being told by external people how much they've done wrong. But it happens all the time. And, you know, anybody who's been in any kind of dispute and has gone to the HR department thinking that they would get the help from the HR department has not understood that HR departments are there to protect the institutions that they represent. And, you know, so it's quite predictable that things that should settle quickly and easily do not. I mean, I don't know if you know, but the BBC journalist Samira Ahmed, she had her tribunal, and that was one about the disparity in what she was paid to what equivalent presenters were paid, and the way, you know, the way she was undervalued by that organization. And she would have, I'm sure, very happily not gone public with it. But when she was forced into a public position, I helped to organize the walks with her to the tribunal every day, because the thing that I remembered most about my time battling time, which went on from the beginning of 2015 until nearly the end of 2018, was how very isolating it feels. It's isolating because you feel exposed. You feel like you'll come under attack at any moment. You are financially exposed. It can have very bad effects on that. And it will damage relationships, because although 99% of people are supportive, there will always be people who are not. There will be former colleagues who think that you shouldn't be doing it, or often, there are also people who feel some unseemly about fighting legal cases. And, you know, that could be in your own family, for example, people who kind of feel like you should, like it's an undignified thing to do. So you have a lot to be contending with. And that's why we did the walks with Samira. And then after Samira's case, which of course she won, we did this with some other people who were at the tribunal. And I think anyone who's having to go to that sort of tribunal, I'd encourage them to do something similar, is turn it into a bit of a party, because, you know, it's going to be painful, but, you know, remind yourself why you're doing it, that it's about creating a better world and not just for yourself.
I think it's very difficult to have that sort of long-term vision when you're in that moment, because all you can think of are the risks and what the fallout could be. I was very lucky. My husband was very supportive, and he's a bit more pragmatic, and he has a bit more perspective than I do, especially in those very acute moments when you're trying to make those decisions. Because obviously I thought I'd lose my medical license. I was worried about that as well. We were worried that we had a baby along the way. What would happen?
I was going to say, you were at such a vulnerable moment. I mean, that I in some way, that's my other point about why I wouldn't urge people always to action, is I was basically old enough and ugly enough, and I decided, like, you know, I wasn't going to, I thought, well, I'm actually not going to go for another staff journalism position, so it doesn't matter if I'm unemployable. You're so much younger, you had a baby on the way, you were like in a profession that could have penalized you both formally and also informally, again, in terms of the way that some of your colleagues would react. No, I think you're immensely brave. I mean, I think it's brilliant that you did what you did. And having a supportive husband, supportive partner, supportive people around you. I mean, Andy, my husband, was amazing about the time thing. He said, I said to him, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Of course you are. Radhika is not allowed to listen to it until she's about 18. So
good. Because I said to him, like, there was one point where it was getting really nasty, and I said to him, like, if I go further, we might actually lose the place we live in because, you know, the costs are getting so high now. And he just went, fuck them. You know, well, and
that's the thing, Catherine. You know, you have to make a decision at that point. And I think having that support system is extremely important, but not just that, but also understanding when your support system needs to change. And I realized that very early on, because the support system I thought I had wasn't the support system that actually got me through. And I had to figure things out, like, you know, who understands what I'm going through? Because I mean, not every doctor in the country has done a legal challenge. Forget that, Catherine. Forget the legal challenge. I mean, doctors weren't even speaking up because they were too scared. They were not even willing to admit there was a problem. And So we're looking at, you know, it was that extreme. So to go from that to trying to figure out, okay, who's in my support bubble? I can only count, like, on one hand who I could turn to when I was having difficult days, when I was struggling. And, you know, during a time where the news was changing all the time, where we were seeing, like, the atrocious decisions that our government was making, you know, it just made me more furious, more angry, and almost to a point where you're just like, well, will we ever see the justice that we want? And I mean, today you saw what happened, you know, with PMQs and everything that's going on at Downing Street right now. You just sit down and think sometimes, like, how many lawsuits do we need to see in this world for change to happen? How many people need to take these corporations and these, you know, these people to court to see what we want to see? Because you mentioned before, you know, that a lot of women are going through very similar problems that people were going through in the 80s, for example. And my biggest worry is that I don't want Radhika to be at university or to be, you know, in her career and going through the same problems that I was, or maybe even that you were in your time. And, you know, you founded the Women's Equality Party, Catherine, which I think is an incredible feminist movement in this country and very much needed as well. But how did you know that it was a right time to do it? How did you know that people would understand what you're trying to achieve? Because I've only realized now in the last year throughout the pandemic that what seems obvious to me isn't really obvious to everybody else.
Yes, well, so many things to unpack there. One thing you've just reminded me of when you mentioned Radhika by name is that it's a name that has wonderful associations for me, because my favorite person at time, or one of my, and I had a lot, there were loads of people I loved at time, but was a woman called Radhika Jones, who has later gone on to be the first woman and first woman of color ever to edit Vanity Fair, who was sort of one of the most supportive people when all of this was going on. So I remember when I realized your baby was called Radhika, I was so happy. so there's a, I don't know if you know of Radhika Jones, but look her up, because there's a great woman already there.
I will, Kath. We actually named Radhika after my protest and everything we did, because the term derived from the Sanskrit word, which means seeker of justice. Well, and I think it was the only fitting name that we could think of during such a turbulent time. So I'll definitely look up Radhika Jones as well.
Well, that's brilliant. Well, and in terms of the timing and the intention, well, again, two things. Also for Radhika's, you know, what world she grows up to. There is a myth that we all grow up with, which is a myth of linear progress, that progress is something that just happens. And it's an incredibly potent myth. And I've met people from all over the world and all sorts of different cultures, and everybody has somehow bought, bought into that. The idea that the world we're in is a better world than the world that came before, and that it will keep getting better. And then there are periods of time that come along, like the one we're in now, which is obviously very extreme and unparalleled in any of our experience. But nevertheless, you know, there are blips that are less profound than this one, where it suddenly reminds you that that's not the case at all, that progress can go backwards. I mean, I say this one is extreme because global pandemic allied with the unfettered rise of the populist right that are actually intent on rolling back progress. It's very hard to ignore the fact that I'm afraid there is a strong possibility that unless we all fight for it, the future won't be brighter that she's growing up to. But that's why we need to fight for it. We need to fight for her. And in terms of it being the right moment, Sandy Toksvig and I co-founded the party, and we hadn't actually planned to do it, but it did emerge out of an analysis of what was going on that proved to be extremely true. We were watching already the stirrings of this new phase, obviously minus the pandemic, but the point about the rise of populism. We were seeing that, for example, Brexit was going to happen, and that people like Donald Trump were going to be elected, not because any of that made sense, but because the ways in which they were talking and the deceptively simple solutions that they were presenting were hitting home in ways that the kind of thinking politics never would. And that was also within the context of the impact of the digital revolution and everything we were talking about social media and this huge kind of social shift. And also a world in which it's not just that misinformation is rampant, but that when there is real information, people don't believe it, you know, so people believe everything and nothing. So all of this was going on, and what that meant with this ancient political system in this country, but also in others, where it's built for a different world, and all the checks and balances that are there for a world that doesn't exist anymore. So just for example, the ways in which they try and guard against wealthy foreigners buying political influence are completely and utterly useless at protecting against the kinds of wealthy foreigners and indeed state actors that help to fund the campaign for Brexit. Because they can do it in sophisticated enough ways that it doesn't get snared by that. And instead, it just puts a huge burden on people who are trying to do politics honestly. So Sandy and I saw all of this, and we saw that the old mainstream parties had become very weak, and that they would mimic anything that they thought was a vote winner. So instead of, for example, pushing against anti-immigration sentiment and saying immigration's actually good and we need it, which is something that, of course, we're now living through, what happens if you get rid of all the people who do essential jobs and make it impossible for them to be here? What we saw that those old mainstream political parties were instead adopting anti-immigration rhetoric themselves, adopting pro-Brexit rhetoric themselves. So we thought, okay, well, the only thing we can do at this point is to see if that works for feminism. Let's see if women's equality let's prove that women's equality is a vote winner. If it's a vote winner, then the other parties will imitate it. So we'll win not only directly, but we'll win by getting the other parties to behave better. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have to say, we were very aware of progress stalling and reversing, and we were very impatient for equality. So, you know, that was the other part of that perception. But we literally thought, okay, you know, you can found a women's group, you can lobby for change, but then they don't really listen to you. The only language they understand is a threat to their electoral majority. Mm. And so that's what we did.
It's that sort of thing that we're seeing now, especially with, you know, Boris Johnson and current cabinet that we have, is that everyone is just thirsty for power and they'll do anything to stay in that position and not let go of it. And I had this discussion with my husband this afternoon when we were watching the PMQs. A few weeks ago, I watched the documentary on Brown and Blair, which is on BBC iPlayer. Yeah. And, you know, watching their interviews, and they talk through their mistakes, they talk through their learning points. And when they were talking, there was some part of me that felt there's a human side to them, you know, like they have these emotions, they understand what's going on, and they're willing to talk about it. They're willing to sit down with somebody, have a discussion, and talk about it. But it seems like now what we've seen with Donald Trump, what we're seeing in our own country, what we see, for example, in India with Modi as well.
Yeah.
There's no humanity in these people. And you just, you know, so even in the PMQs, someone asked Boris Johnson, how do you sleep at night? And that's always my question. How do these people sleep at night knowing the damage that they're doing? And I'm very scared that this is going to have a snowball effect and people will actually continue to go down this trajectory and might be too late to turn back.
I think it's a wise thing to be scared of. And that's also why I'm an activist, is I think we're in a period of extraordinary danger and extraordinary turbulence, and it can go two ways. The thing about turbulence is that it's also when you can make the most progress. If you look at when progress for women's happened, for example, it's no coincidence that the first enfranchisement of women came at the end of the First World War here. You look at the incredible increase in female participation in the labor force that happened during the Second World War. So I'm not saying war is a good thing, far from it. But what I'm saying is when things feel comfortable, change doesn't happen. And it's often that when things get stirred up, there's a moment where you can make a huge amount of change, but it can also go in the opposite direction. So you have to be very much aware of that. And I think in politics there's several different things going on, but you know, I mentioned the way in which journalism has gone downhill. Politics has gone so extraordinarily downhill. And again, my great age means that the first cabinet members that I actually interviewed as a journalist were members of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet. And I did actually meet and interview her as well. And although she remains a hate figure for so many on the left, she's a very different kind of politician to the one who's around now. She's a conviction politician. She did all sorts of things that I, you know, vehemently disagreed with, but the quality, she was a very, very skilled politician, and she was somebody who believed in public service, even if the route she took was very different. What we have descended to now is this incredible diminution of quality of politicians. So, you know, the Blair and Brown era, Downing Street was absolutely full of talented people. You know, all the ministries were full of talented people, and it wasn't just the people who were at the top of their parties. It was, they were in the back benches. There were people who you could see who were potential future leaders or future ministers. And that has changed. And there are lots of reasons why it's changed. But it's one of the other things about the world we inhabit is that it rewards the kind of narcissistic show-offery that, you know, was embodied by Donald Trump, but is also very visible in our current prime minister. And those are not people with any beliefs at all, other than their own, they believe in themselves and their divine right to govern, and they, there is no humanity because they literally don't care about other people. And that, I'm not saying that's true of everybody in politics at the moment. There are definitely a lot of people who still believe in public service, but there has been a cultural shift towards that kind of politics and that kind of politician, and it's very, very damaging. You mentioned Modi. I mean, look at Duterte in the Philippines. Look at what's been going on in Brazil with Bolsonaro. Look at the death rates in Brazil. You know, it's from COVID, with, because a populist response to what was going on made people more vulnerable.
Why do you think the quality of politicians is going down, Catherine? Is there something that you can pinpoint as to what exactly the reason is? Because I've been trying to figure that out, as in, why is it that we're having everybody who's at a certain standard or level of thinking coming in all at the same time?
So one of the things that's so exciting about the Women's Equality Party and doing that work is you actually see what might be possible if you had, if you opened up politics to the people who are excluded from it. So the Women's Equality Party, there have been these candidates who have run in elections who are just so brilliant. And you kind of think, like, yes, of course, that's who we need in government. And you look at Mandy Reid, who is the current leader of the party, or indeed Sophie Walker, who was the leader of the party before her. Those are women that would do, you know, they would grace politics, not just with immense talent, but with perspectives that and experiences that that are not well enough represented in politics. And so the answer is, again, like all of these things, it's complicated, but the reason why there aren't more women in politics is part of the answer to your bigger question. So there aren't more women in politics, partly because women are structurally poorer, both in terms of time and money. They have more caring duties, all of that. There's also the hostile environment. The politics is not shaped for women. It neither takes account of the sorts of levels of commitment or lack of finance, nor does it welcome them in other ways. And, you know, most women in Westminster, the very high numbers of women in Westminster will have been harassed, for example. So there's all of that. There's also the ways in which the electoral systems work in this country and in many others. First past the post, it favours incumbents, and incumbents are mostly going to already be a majority of what was already there, so white men, and of a particular background. The media environment, because it is also full of people like that, they're going to get better coverage, and they're going to get coverage which reinforces rather than challenges. But then there's this much more difficult area. So all of that's very easy to resolve. You know, all of that, you just need to understand, to see what the structural barriers are, and you can find ways to resolve them. The harder thing is, you know, I kept using the very antiquated phrase in some ways, the digital revolution. You know, it's actually about a world in which data and metadata trails you wherever you go. You are giving off, you know, in having this conversation on Zoom, you know, God knows how much information about us is being collected. And I don't mean the kind of information people get paranoid about. It's the kind of diaphanous information that would mean nothing on its own, but in bulk goes to create a picture of who you are or what's happening in the world. And the workings of algorithms, the impact, the profound impact of social media, the profound impact of a world in which, as I say, that you leave these sort of trails of data. the way that interacts with the old analog political system is absolutely disastrous. So we saw a tiny bit of that in terms of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, but that Cambridge Analytica is the tip of an iceberg. It's not, people mistook that for an iceberg. It's not even really the tip of an iceberg. It's not even the tip of the iceberg. It's just a small piece of ice floating about there. The world has changed and is changing profoundly as a result of this huge technological shift. And it is combining with all sorts of other strands and strains to create enormous change. And it's having a disastrous effect on politics. But it's something, again, it informs my activism. It makes me want to leap in there. And if you understand some of the waves that are happening, you can possibly surf them as well as being swallowed by them. You know, we can maybe try for some good change as well as trying to resist all the bad stuff that's happening.
Yeah, well, Catherine, we're having such an interesting conversation. I mean, we could go on for much longer, but I know that you have to leave as well, and so do I. But before we end this lovely conversation we've had today, I just wanted to touch a little bit upon the book that you wrote this last year, Good Grief.
Yeah.
And I just finished reading it over the weekend. And I mean, as a doctor, no one teaches you how to deal with a grieving patient. Forget just a grieving patient, but a grieving family. And your book has really taught me so much as a doctor, but also just as a family member as well. So thank you for sharing your story as well as your mother's as well. And I know that you were writing this book and you were meeting your mother on a weekly basis during the pandemic, and you were sitting in your living room having these conversations. And would you have ever connected with your mother in this way if it wasn't for this book?
No. But well, when you say the book, I don't think it's so much the book. It's what happened was that we both were widowed at the start of the pandemic. You know, you don't expect, I guess nobody's prepared for that sort of loss anyway, how much you fear it. And I think both of us were very deeply in love with the people we were with, and we both feared their loss as being the worst thing that could happen to us. And then the worst thing that could happen happened. But then something else happened, which was the global pandemic meant that we were also then locked down and prevented from seeing anyone just after we'd been widowed. So I think you have to say that combination of circumstances meant that we had a strange and unwanted, in so many ways, understanding of what the other was going through. So no, I can't imagine that we'd have connected in the same way. But it's also, I mean, there were so many other things that fed into it. Like, I was only seeing my mother under the caregiving rules, because unlike the people in government, we were being incredibly careful to follow the rules. And I was very, very careful about it, not least because I didn't want to accidentally kill my mother as well by bringing COVID into the house. And so I was seeing her to do the stuff. You know, she was 86 when she was widowed. She's just turned 88. She'd never been on her, she never lived on her own in her entire life. And there's just a ton of stuff she doesn't know how to do, and things she can't reach, and things she's not strong enough to do. And I was the only one I have two sisters and a stepsister, but I was the only one who had flexibility in work terms and didn't have exposure to children, who of course are, as you know, vectors of infection. And so it just made more sense for me to be the one who went there.
Is your mother still writing letters to John?
Yes. So yeah. My mother started writing letters to my dead stepfather, because, you know, if you've lost the person who you're closest to in the world, and the world itself has turned on its head, then I guess writing letters to the dead person you love makes as much sense as anything else. And her letters are amazing. And that's why we wrote the book, is because I, you know, because I'm a writer anyway. So my publisher had come to me and said, why don't you write a memoir of losing your husband, Andy? And I said, no, actually, I don't want to. But look at these wonderful letters my mother's written. Why don't you publish those? And my publisher came back and said, no, you need to do it. You need to write the book that goes around the letters. And then when I started doing it, it all made sense. And then I was glad that I'd done it.
Wow. Well, Catherine, we've had a conversation from your times as journalist. We went into politics and we've discussed a lot, and it's very clear that you've done a lot. It's also very clear that you're not going to stop. Do you have anything planned next now over the next few years?
Well, so we actually haven't even touched on two huge areas of my activities, and I'm not suggesting we go into them in detail, but you know, when my husband Andy Gill was a founder of the band Gang of Four, and he had a huge album on that was nearly finished. Well, it was sort of nearly, it was well advanced, I should say, when he died, and he was literally working on it in his hospital bed. And so I, of course, decided I had to finish it. So I've just exec produced a double album with all these famous artists like the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Massive Attack and La Rue and Gary Numan and whatever. And I'm on a daily basis embroiled in the music industry, which I really, really hate the music industry, but I love Andy and I love music. So that's why I'm doing that. And I'm also the co-founder of a festival of creativity called Prima Donna Festival. And I mean, Omicron permitting and all of that, we're intending to run the festival in real life in the summer of the coming summer, and tickets are already on sale and we're already planning for it. And I'm writing another book. So, and you know, and the paperback of Good Grief is coming out with this and all this these new chapters. And so really there's a ton of stuff. So what with the politics and the festival and the music and the writing, but you know, I also campaign with the COVID bereaved families, because of course Andy was probably one of the first victims of COVID in this country, and there needs to be a not just a public inquiry but a meaningful public inquiry into what happened, so that lessons can be learned and lives saved. But I think my overall approach to life, to adversity, to everything that's going on, is to try and find a way to turn it to some kind of positive change, because that's the one huge opportunity in the period of time we're in now, is if we can't take this turbulence, if we can't take the pain of all of this loss and the learnings from that and turn it to something positive, then we will be making something that was already a tragedy a kind of a double tragedy. And I don't think that's necessary. I think we can honor our dead and honor our beliefs by doing more right now, not less.
Well, Catherine, I'm very excited to see what the next few years, you know, bring. And I definitely need to just check out this Prima Donna Festival. And I was going to talk about it, but we spoke about so many other things that I didn't get a chance to touch upon it. But thank you so much for joining me today, Catherine. I appreciate your time. And I had such a great time chatting.
How about instead of you talking about Prima Donna, you come and appear at Prima Donna? I think it would be absolutely brilliant if you would come and speak there. Do the podcast there. There would be so many people.
Wow. I mean, I've actually got goosebumps right now. That's incredible. We need to talk about this later, Catherine. I'll drop you an email.
Okay.
That sounds great, Catherine. That sounds really great. I hope you enjoyed this chat. We spoke about many different things, and I'm sure we'll give our listeners a perspective on politics, what it means to be a feminist, and I'm sure people will pick up your book as well, Catherine. So we'll stay in touch, and thank you so much for your time today.
Well, it was lovely speaking to you. Thank you.
Thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. And a huge, huge thanks to Catherine as well for giving me your time. I think this is the first time a guest has actually said, well, Meal, there are still quite a few things we didn't touch upon an hour into our recording. But as you can see, Catherine has got so much wisdom to share. She's got so much experience. And I really hope you do pick up her book, Good Grief. It's out in hardback at the moment. And I believe the paperback will be coming out sometime in February. It's a great book. It gives you great insight, not just into grief and life and death, but what people really went through during the pandemic. I'm sure a lot of you will be able to learn a lot from it. Thank you for joining me this week. We have another great guest coming up next week. I won't tell you who it is just yet. I'll tell you probably a few days before I release it, because with Radhika around, my schedule has become very chaotic. So I don't want to promise anything or count my chickens too early. but if you enjoyed this episode, please do subscribe. Please leave a review on iTunes. Please share it with your friends. It will really help the podcast reach out to more people. And if you are on social media, you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Dr. Meenal Viz. So that's Dr. Meenal Viz, and that's my name. And you can also find more episodes on my website, which is meenalviz.com. I've got a library of about 50 episodes, which you can enjoy. And most of them are, again, really great guests who I've had in the last year or so. So thank you all for tuning in, and I hope you have a lovely weekend, and I'll see you all next week.